This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. When it comes to HB 2, everybody is suing everybody. And this week, Governor McCrory filed suit against the Department of Justice. The legislature filed their own suit against the feds, and the DOJ is suing the state. City budget discussions are continuing with some horse trading going on over trash collection at apartments and a potential rise in the property tax. Meanwhile, the school board has asked the county for an additional $23 million, and they say that really isn't enough. And believe it or not, the General Assembly is working on things other than HB 2, including penalties for drunken boating in an effort to revive coal ash oversight. And one of our own, Stephen Curry, makes basketball history. Those and other stories on our weekly local news roundup this hour. WFAE's Tom Bullock is here, along with Nick Oxner from WBTV News. Hillary Byrne, staff writer from the Charlotte Business Journal, is here. And so is Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Good morning to you all. Welcome.
Good morning.
Let's start with something that came down late last night or late yesterday afternoon. And that is the fact that the Obama administration is sending out a letter to school districts today, adding to a highly charged debate over transgender rights. And that letter will say that all public schools will have to make allowances in bathrooms for transgender students. Was this a surprise?
I don't think it was really a surprise. I mean, it's part of a broader effort here. And honestly, I did a long interview with Dan Bishop, who, of course, is the sponsor of House Bill 2. I talked with him the grand day of lawsuits when everybody would seem to be suing everybody else. And he said very clearly that he saw what was happening with the DOJ, the Department of Justice lawsuit, and everything else as a broader plan on behalf of the Obama administration, whereas they wanted to advance this issue before President Barack Obama left office. And that's not a partisan statement. I think this letter shows that that is, in fact, the case, that the President Obama and through his administration, they are really pushing this issue. Basically, what the letter says, we were talking about this before we went on air, it just basically says, don't be North Carolina. And what's interesting here is it lays out a series of best practices. It lays out a series of steps where parents of a transgender student can say, all right, our child now is, from male to female or female to male, and that school districts should use the appropriate pronoun, and that schools should also make sure that that student is allowed access to the exact same facilities that everyone else is, meaning –
The letter says as soon as a child's parents or legal guardian asserts a gender identity for the student that differs from previous representations or records, the child is to be treated accordingly without any requirement for a medical diagnosis or birth certificate to be produced. And that begins when?
When the parent says so, when the parent makes contact with the school.
This takes effect when?
When the parent makes contact with the school.
But I mean, this new recommendation or rule, which does not have the force of law, takes effect in the schools when?
Now.
As of today.
And I think that's an interesting point to see that the Obama administration continues to try to make law and policy through the White House, right? And that's something when I talked with Representative Robert Pittenger in Washington on Tuesday, he said that he and other members of Congress were very concerned about the implications for what allowing the Justice Department to enforce these rules, to send down orders like this, what that says for the separation of powers and about the executive branch, no matter who's in office, kind of making laws.
Well,
and
are they making laws or are they simply clarifying what they think the civil rights
Well, I guess the important kind of distinction or the rubber hits the road on this is that they feel like they have already been sort of given kind of a tacit green light from the Fourth Circuit in that Virginia case with the transgender student who, in that case, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals basically said to the Justice Department and the federal bureaucracy that you have the right to interpret the law as you see, as you see fit on this particular issue. You have jurisdiction to do that. Now, whether or not that will stand when it gets to the Supreme Court level, that's still up for debate.
But the interesting thing is, no, this is not law. This is an interpretation. An interpretation, the administration's interpretation of rules that are already set out of those laws. But here's the thing. you're hearing from, let's just use our state as an example, you're hearing from Republican representatives and senators saying, hey, this is government overreach, this is an administration going far too far, that they don't have the rule of law behind them. But let's just go back to the last presidency, and what do you see? Let's take, you know, the EPA rules as a good example. When the you know, President Bush's administration interpreted the laws differently, and you had Democrats saying the same thing. You know, this is nothing new. This fight and the use of these definitions, these interpretations of law, have been going on for a long time in America. So one of the core arguments that I find rather rather strange to me, I'll just leave it at strange, is the fact that they say, oh, well, this is just the Obama administration overreaching. But they're in power for the next 8 months, and that's their right. That is a precedent that has been set by – Nick, you're shaking your head back and forth. But Republicans and Democrats have done this, and as long as they are in the White House, that is their ability.
And isn't that what the executive branch is supposed to do, execute the laws, and the Department of Justice is doing this, not just the White House?
I do wonder, though, just as a tactical thing, whether or not this was the smartest tactical move for the Justice Department and the Obama administration at this point, because you've basically had HB2 supporters in North Carolina basically calling for the rest of the country to come in and look at what they're doing to us in North Carolina.
That's a good point.
They're trying to, you know, do all this radical left-wing stuff. And now you basically have the administration saying, you know, putting its, you know, 800-pound stamp on it going, yes, we are, and no, you all better do what we say.
Let's go back.
So now you're going to have all these other, you know, folks
it's
flooding
a very good
in.
Point
let's
the,
go back to
debate.
Something I think you said, Tom, and that was the fact that people have believed that this has been a long-standing plan on the part of the Obama administration to put these things into effect before he leaves office. And if that is true, and we don't know that it is or isn't, but if it is true, could the Charlotte ordinance that started all of this have been part of that plan? I mean,
yes.
Roberts is a Democrat. She's met with the president. Could it have been a part of the plan?
Absolutely, and I think there's increasing talk about the motivations behind Jennifer Roberts in Raleigh and in Charlotte, of the motivation behind Jennifer Roberts for bringing the bathroom ordinance back up in Charlotte as she took her spot on the city council's mayor. And so there's lots of speculation now, some of it that I've heard very credible, that this was absolutely an orchestrated plan. She knew what she was doing. There are other motivations behind it, and I think we'll have to wait to see that play out as we move down the road.
Now, the interesting thing to me there, is it possible? Sure. But it assumes a certain high level of coordination that you rarely see politicians actually able to pull off. Sometimes they do. You're right. But here's the other thing, though, and here's the mixed message and why I understand the point. I'm not fully prepared to accept it yet. There's a mixed message coming out of the Obama administration right now dealing with this issue, which is they will not withhold federal funds until this plays out in court. Now, these court cases, now we're up to five that I know of, could take months, if not years, to play out. So, yes, you know, this now is clearly part of a broader plan. We're going to try to do this all over the place. But why then, I would ask, would you not be prepared to start using – if this is all a big goal to try to get this done before President Barack Obama leaves office, then why are you taking away the biggest stick that you have in this fight?
Well, because that's really, really hard. And you have to remember, too, that we're in an election year. We have a very contested governor's race. And who wants to be in the party that takes away education funding from our students, right? When you look at historical enforcement of Title IX across colleges and universities, Title IX used much more – for sports and more recently for enforcing sexual assault reporting requirements and laws on campuses. There have been egregious actual violations of Title IX that are like just cut and dry clear on colleges and universities, and the Department of Education's response to that and tactic has not been to take any of their funding away, even when there have been egregious violations. And so I basically out of the thought and policy that it's just really bad to take away people's funding. And so I think they jumped the gun a little bit by coming out and saying, well, we can take away your, what, $400 million or however much it was. We can take away all your education funding, North Carolina. I think they jumped the gun. It is something that they could do, but I don't think anyone who has traditionally paid attention to how they use that stick, so to speak, actually believed that that was going to
happen. No, but it is the one thing that actually led to desegregation in schools? What actually caused Brown versus Board of Education to be enacted here in the South was the federal government effectively saying, here's your deadline, we will take your funds away.
Going back to Charlotte, to Jennifer Roberts' motivations for putting this in the first place, I'm wondering what you're hearing. I'm just wondering why Charlotte? Why would Charlotte be the place that, to get Obama's mission through?
Well, perhaps because they put it through almost 6 months prior to that, and, and I'm just answering. I don't know.
Yeah, well, and I think that's a good point, right? Is this is not something that was a new debate in Charlotte. This is something, and when you had a change in council makeup, you had a new mayor, you had a couple new council members, and you know, I think the ground was tilled.
And how much of a role do you think is the fact that we have Anthony Fox, a former Charlotte mayor, and Carolyn Flowers, the former Charlotte head of CATS, in the Obama administration?
I actually think a better tie, and
Charlotte has a high profile there.
Well, I think a closer tie, if you really want to look at this, and I've argued against it, so now I will argue for it now, is not necessarily the former mayors that are in high positions in the Obama administration, but if you look at Jennifer Roberts' campaign team, which is based, you know, it was a national level team that I believe was based out of Illinois, you could argue that as a closer tie to the Obama administration than Anthony Fox.
Well, let's go back to the news that started this week of all of this, and that is the fact that everybody is suing everybody. This is the issue that we can't flush out of our system, HB2.
That was terrible.
Thank you very much.
Even for public radio.
So we have the governor suing the federal government. We have the legislature suing the federal government. We have the federal government suing the state. On what basis?
On the basis of everything that we've been talking about, which is, you know, is this or is this not the violation of a single word, sex, that is a protected class in federal law? And that's what this fight is about, is what defines sex? Is sex simply
– is that the right word? Shouldn't it be gender?
No. In federal law, it's sex. And that's why I'm using that word.
All right.
I mean, and let's not forget that the federal law in question was written in, you know, 1963 and passed in 1964. So it's not surprising. You go through – you can find all sorts of words that we would not use freely now in that law. But the point of the matter is it boils down to all these sides want a federal judge to decide whether or not the word sex protects gender identity and gender expression. And that will – once those decisions come down – and we could have a split decision just on these lawsuits.
Sure.
And then you're going to have a whole series of appeals likely up to the Supreme Court.
So looking at the crux of the lawsuits against the federal government, and I've heard McCrory on all these national interviews he's doing, he keeps asking for clarity. He wants clarity whether this is illegal. What exactly does transgender mean? He's asking for clarity. Doesn't Obama's decree going out today give some kind of clarity that
not
he's looking
for? Not the clarity
for?
He wants.
Well, not the clarity he wants, and not in any kind of authoritative mean. I mean, okay, so it's easy to say, look at everyone suing everyone. But actually, this is a question, and this is why our court systems exist, is to answer differences in the interpretation of the law.
Correct.
And so, you know, you can say what you will about, oh, we're using tax dollars to do this. But this is an important question, clearly, that needs to be resolved. And that's why our court system exists, is to have these people in black robes, you know, break out their dictionaries and tell us what these words mean.
But as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, the Violence Against Women Act does see transgender people as a protected class. Doesn't that answer the question in 10 seconds or less?
Not when it comes to Title IX and Title VII funding, not when it comes to federal contracting, so not in a lot of ways.
Okay, we'll take a break. We'll come back with a little more of this, not much, as we have other things to talk about. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Belgrave Associates, helping to align marketing and communication strategies with clients' business plans through branding, content curation, digital marketing, and customer relations. Details at BelgraveAssociates.com. And Nexen Pruitt, hosting an employment law certificate webinar series focusing on wage and hour compliance and litigation on June 8th at noon. Details online at nplaw.com. The current debate over transgender rights may have started in Charlotte, but now it has become national. And so on Monday on this program at 9, we will look at the legal ins and outs of the multiple lawsuits that have been filed and examine the politics of all this. That's Monday morning. And also, we're working on another series of voter roundtables for Charlotte Talks later this month. And in particular, we are looking for conservative-leaning voters and women. If you match that description and you'd like to be part of all this, you can find out more about it and get in touch with our producers at WFAE.org.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, Donald Trump meets with GOP leaders on Capitol Hill. The House approves a bill to launch an opioids task force. And North Carolina and the Justice Department sue each other over transgender rights.
The weekly news roundup continues on the Ian Rehm Show next at 10 on 90.7 WFAE. Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's our weekly news roundup with Tom Bullock from WFAE News. Nick Oxner. I had the wrong name on the top of the page. Nick Oxner from WBTV News. Hillary Burns from...
Charlotte Business Thank Journal.
You, the Charlotte Business Journal, and Eric Frazier from the Charlotte Observer.
It's Mike's first time hosting.
Yes, I've never done this before, so give me a break. Give me a break. All right, going back to the situation in North Carolina with HB2, at stake is $2 billion in Title IX funding, much of which goes to the University of North Carolina system, and that puts them between a rock and a hard place because they had nothing to do with this. Their board of directors or board of governors met this week. Mm-hmm. What was the outcome?
They pled for more time. They basically told the U.S. Justice Department, we're trying to figure this out. And what's interesting to me is if you actually look at the lawsuits that were filed by state leaders, Governor McCrory's lawsuit did not bring up Title IX funding at all. And we were all kind of scratching our heads as to why Speaker Tim Moore and Senate Pro Tem Phil Berger would put out their own lawsuit. And then all of a sudden we saw, oh, there's the Title IX reference. So basically the UNC system cannot function, physically cannot function without federal funding because it's not just money that's going to campuses for sports teams. It also includes students' ability to apply for things like Pell Grants. It's significant. It has a huge impact on the campus system. And Margaret Spellings and the Board of Governors have come out and basically said, we're trying to figure this out. They have their own legal counsel. They're trying to figure out a way to – they really are. It's not just hyperbole. They really are stuck between a rock and a hard place. They have to follow federal guidelines to keep that funding, and they also have to follow state law. So they're trying to walk – and that so far, I have to say, have done a pretty good job of walking a very fine line between both sides and have tried to make this as their decision as – apolitical as I think feasible.
But I thought it was interesting after that meeting they kind of said, we're a university, we can't affect the law, we have to follow the law, but that doesn't mean we have to enforce the law because the law doesn't say how it would be enforced, which made me pause and say, well, wait a minute, why are we all fighting about a law that won't even...
Yeah, really.
That takes us back to how we opened this program, yeah. And that is that letter that's going out from the Obama administration ordering the public schools to immediately make bathrooms available to transgender students. Does that mean public universities as well? Or public grade and high schools?
My understanding, it's the latter because it's being sent out to school districts. Now, I could be wrong in that interpretation. It could be going out to colleges as well. But regardless, it's you know, university systems are trying to figure this out as best they can because Title IX funding, again, it is absolutely key.
Yeah.
And as of right now, there are – you know, nobody's enforcing this. But to Hillary's point – the first note that we had about House Bill 2 from Margaret Spellings was telling colleges to figure out how they will enforce this, how they will follow the law. That is the point of the law. It has to be followed. Specifically, in the law, it talks about the university system. So there is no ambiguity there. So the first note was to say, hey, we have to enforce this, start coming up with a plan. And now they're kind of walking that back a bit to say, well, let's see what happens. So that one is very much a stay tuned proposition.
You mentioned, Nick, that you went to Washington to talk to Representative Robert Pittenger this week, who we've already said thinks that there's overreach here in the Obama administration. He went on to say that also that it could possibly be the DOG stuff could be unconstitutional.
Yeah, and he raised that question that I referenced earlier about the separation of powers here, you know, between making laws and enforcing laws. Representative Pittenger said that he envisioned he and his colleagues in Congress addressing this on a larger scale as a whole as we move down the road a little bit and taking a look at what they can do to further define the Article I separation of powers issues. And look, I think it's fair to go back to our point between Tom and I. Sure, every president has the prerogative to do these executive orders and to kind of govern by fiat. You know, Representative Pittenger called it governing, legislating by press conference this week. And every president does that. I don't know that that's necessarily the right thing. And I think you've seen presidents from both parties do this as time goes on, continue to expand the power of the executive branch. And I think there is actually a legitimate question in asking, is that appropriate? And at what point do you break, you know, the balance?
How often does the executive branch lose? How often when the Department of Justice sues somebody for something, do they lose? How often do they bring a suit that they feel they can't win?
In the case of these types of situations, they've been pretty successful.
Yeah.
I think what this all sort of points to me is just sort of the like Hillary mentioned that McCrory's been asking for clarity, and he's been asking in a lot of instances for the Congress to bring clarity, and that's the last place you're going to get clarity on any major point these days, which sort of points to just how broken and divided and divisive things have gotten, and the huge role that the Supreme Court is going to play, because ultimately they're going to decide this because our politicians can't and won't reach any consensus on it.
And one of the most fascinating things to me about this is the fact that this is happening on an election year where the de facto Republican nominee, Donald Trump, is against House Bill 2. He has said so very publicly. That may actually benefit if there is this feared down ballot effect that a lot of people are talking about. And you can argue about whether or not Hillary Clinton has a down ballot effect as well, a separate conversation. But the point is this may be a way for Republicans in the House of Representatives and Republican senators to draw a pretty bright line between Donald Trump and themselves to try to bolster their chances on a ballot.
And I guess going back to my point on McCrory asking for clarity, that was kind of my way of saying it just seems like he's just talking. He's just enjoying the national spotlight and saying, look, we're innocent. We just want clarity here. And it's like, do you really? Is that really what you're asking for? Or are you just soaking in the spotlight?
Interesting you should bring up the national spotlight, because we have repeatedly tried to get the governor on this program, and he used to come on at the drop of a hat, and now we cannot get him even to his press people to even return our email requests to be on this program. So I texted him this week and asked him to look into that, and he said he would, but that he'd been on Diane Rehm earlier this week.
Which I heard.
Not the same thing, Governor. As a program note, we will be doing an entire hour on the legal and political aspects of HB 2, from which the suits that we've been talking about here make the best legal arguments, and to the political ramifications of having the very public disagreement over alleged discrimination during a presidential election year. We'll be doing that Monday morning on this program at 9. Before we move on, Twitter comments. I wonder if the General Assembly understands irony when they used overreach to stop the Charlotte ordinance, then complain when the Department of Justice does it. Ray on Twitter, the ordinance was orchestrated by voters. The council was largely elected on this issue. There was no surprise. Are we going to just ignore the Fourth Circuit's interpretation? Meanwhile, getting back to the governor, who's not here to defend himself because he chooses not to be, Democrats are crying foul because the state is paying for Pat McCrory's travel expenses to appear on national television to talk about this topic. He flew to Washington to make a couple of pit stops on Fox and Meet the Press, I believe. This happens usually with presidents who are seemingly using their office to make political points. Is he doing this to make political points, or is he doing this as the governor of the state?
It's an election year. Yeah,
there
everything's political.
Talk about a distinction without a difference. I mean, this is, you know, I've seen a lot of people complain about this, and you know what? It's easy to see an argument where the governor says he's doing the business of the state. You may not like him going on television to talk about stuff. Mike, obviously we know you don't like the fact that he hasn't talked to you. But
I'm just puzzled by it.
But this is...
I thought we were best buds.
This is not uncommon. I'm pretty sure that if you looked at a Democratic governor from a state where there was some controversy going to a Sunday show, they probably were... That tab was probably picked up by the taxpayer as well.
There are a lot better hits you can land on Governor McCrory than criticizing him for taking the state plane to travel and talk on behalf of the state.
Well, he's gotten extraordinary coverage on this, some because he's appeared and some because they're using his clips on other shows like Comedy Central. But is he trying to build a national profile? Is that what's happening here?
It seems like it. I mean, how could we not think that when he's not going on local shows and he's spending his time up in Washington and on Meet the Press? It's interesting to watch. And the ironic part is I think he's making his trail of fire even bigger as he goes, because as more and more people learn about this, he's not helping himself here.
I think he's also trying to, I think when the Justice Department got involved in all this, I think there was a lot of sort of, you know, shrinking back, even though they didn't do this publicly, but I think a lot of the HB2 supporters in Raleigh were kind of like, oh my God, this is not what we, you know, were bargaining for. And they kind of started all these calls for, you know, sort of raising the point that this is a national issue. This is a national issue. And I think they were sort of calling for the cavalry, you know, conservatives from around America, come and help us. You know, this, you know, the Obama, you know, thugs are trying to force this, you know, stuff down our throats.
Has anybody noticed that the only time we get national attention here in Charlotte is either when the Panthers go to the Super Bowl, or when the Democratic National Convention is here, or when there's this dispute between local officials and the arts community over Angels in America, which made national headlines, and now this?
There does seem to be a pattern.
There's a pattern, yes.
Can we count Steph Curry as national attention for Charlotte?
We'll get to that.
Okay.
The Charlotte Observer reported this week that high school students in the Rowan-Salisbury schools will be permitted to take mace and pepper spray to school beginning in August. Why?
The stated fear was that you'll have teenage boys who will go in the girls' bathroom, because now bathrooms are gender neutral, and so I can go in anyone I want. So I'm going to go in here and look at some girls. And so they feel like, you know, by allowing girls to carry mace, that then they can ward off the boys or transgenders or whoever is going to, you know, or fake transgender, I guess.
Does this demonstrate a fundamental lack of understanding of
gender? Oh yeah, very definitely. I mean, it. I think it demonstrates the exact sort of fault line where people part ways on this, and where they can't come together, because there's a fundamental difference on the left and the right about how people see this. People on the left see it as you're making accommodations for a persecuted minority that needs help. People on the right see this as that's craziness. That's all in their heads. They just need some, maybe they just need some help, or they need to sit down and think about who they really are. But you can't just open the floodgates and let anybody come in any bathroom, because that's going to make women and girls unsafe.
But isn't a boy in a dress, and I don't mean that to be disrespectful, but isn't a boy in a dress more endangered in a men's room than he is endangering others in a women's room?
Well, you saw in the, I think there was a press conference yesterday in which transgender, LGBT and transgender folks were talking about these things, and there was a transgender woman who said that she had been trying to follow HB2. She looks like a woman externally, but she still has male on her birth certificate. But HB2 says you go to the men's bathroom. Mm-hmm. So she said she went in there and she got harassed and kicked out of the male, you know, the men's bathroom. So it kind of speaks to, you know, where this stuff does not translate into common sense on the ground.
And it's one of the ironies of the law. And it really is, because if the law was set up to try to stop people from going into bathrooms where they will stand out or they may do something nefarious, and it's important to point out the data, national data collected over years, shows none of these problems happening. now you have the exact same situation, but in reverse. Mm-hmm. And it's a strange irony of the law. And when it comes to this Rowan decision, I keep going back to the idea that you heard from, you know, Republicans in Raleigh when right before they voted for and immediately after House Bill 2 was passed, that the Charlotte ordinance was not necessary. It was, you know, a solution in search of a problem. Well, this ordinance, this decision by Rowan Schools seems to be the same thing to mm-hmm. me. And it's also just kind of creating this idea of there's something to fear. And I data just doesn't show it. And I'm a father. I have a five-year-old daughter. I take this stuff very, very seriously. But I still stand by something I said long ago, which is I am and should be more concerned with the sanitary conditions of a bathroom that my daughter goes into right. than any of these other situations that sure. you know we're hearing from school boards and legislative leaders in North Carolina.
It speaks to kind of the irrationalness of the fear, because when you look at what the Obama administration is saying about how to – do this in terms of, you know, allowing transgender kids to use the bathroom of their choice. It's not saying any boy who wants to, you know, okay, I'm going to be a girl today so I can go look at the girls in the girls' bathroom. It does not say that that will be allowed. It says parents have to, you know, sort of certify that my kid mm-hmm. has these issues and go to the school. And any non-transgender boy is not going to want his parents coming to school and saying, yeah, he's a transgender. That ain't going to happen. So, you know, it's a lot of irrational fear just flying around.
Switching gears here. Nick Oxner, on Thursday you broke a story on WBTV, about Duke Energy lobbying state health and environmental officials to reverse a do-not-drink order which was sent to residents with well water that was maybe contaminated by coal-powered plants. Talk about that, because this is a kind of a strange thing.
Very strange coincidence, if you want to call it that. Yeah, we don't know exactly why. So there are 240 households, all of whom are near Duke Energy coal-powered plants in Belmont and Salisbury, just to name a couple, others across the state, who in 2015 got a letter from jointly from DHHS and Department of what is now Department of Environmental Quality that said your well water has tested high for two kinds of elements, hexavalent chromium and vanadium. Hexavalent chromium was the chemical in Aaron Brockovich.
Mm. Okay. So don't drink it.
Yes. So they said, don't drink the water. Okay. So in March of this year, about a year later, the state came out and said, yeah, we changed our mind. That water is just as safe as the public drinking water. And folks kind of scratched their head. Quite frankly, the claims made by state regulators is not supported by data. We did that in our investigation last month. It's just not supported by the data. So yesterday, a deposition was unsealed that was taken of the state toxicologist, Dr. Megan Davies, earlier this month. And she said that Duke Energy lobbyist representatives, other Duke officials, met with state regulators after they sent these do not drink orders, and Duke voiced concern and asked for the do not drink letters to be rescinded, which is significant in and of itself. More significant to me is the language that Dr. Davies said Duke Energy used in lobbying to get this overturned. She says that Duke said, look, this holds these wells to a higher standard than anyone else in the country. No one else is held to this, and so you need to not do this. That is the exact same language that Dr. Randall Williams, Deputy Secretary of DHHS, told me in a sit-down interview in March. It is exactly the same language that state regulators were using to justify this stunning reversal.
So is this the tip of an iceberg that is yet to be covered?
Yes, I think we will see much more about this. And I think it just once again raises questions about Pat McCrory's relationship with Duke Energy, his longtime employer.
Is this another Flint in process?
It could be, because there are some very grave questions about the safety of this water. Mm. Absolutely.
When we come back, we're going to talk about the where we stand on the possible 1% tax increase in the city of Charlotte, the school board asking for $23 million additional dollars and saying it's really not enough, and some other things going on in the General Assembly that may impact you. But we'll have to take a break first. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and UNC's Nutrition Research Institute, presenting a public lecture on the importance of our gut microbiome to health and how microbial studies are leading toward personalized diets for optimal health. May 17th, 6 p.m., details at UNC. NRI.org. And ScoopCharlotte.com, providing women in Charlotte daily info on health, parenting, decorating, and things to do. Presenting the Scoop each week with ScoopCharlotte.com. Donald Trump meets with GOP leaders on Capitol Hill. The House approves a bill to launch an opioids task force, and North Carolina and the Justice Department suing each other over transgender rights. Just a couple of the stories they'll be talking about with the panel of journalists on the National Weekly News Roundup coming up at 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can get to us through email, charlottetalks@wfae.org, or on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
They say you are what you eat, so how much media do you consume every day? Are you gorging yourself on everything in sight, snacking between meals, sneaking the occasional tweet? I'm Audie Cornish. Look, if you've tried all the other news outlets but just aren't seeing results, check out the All Things Considered diet, weekdays. More news, less filler.
Hear the latest news from NPR plus WFAE news updates from the Charlotte region on All Things Considered, weekdays from 4 to 6:30 p.m. on WFAE.
Hey, Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's our weekly news roundup with Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Nick Oxner from WBTV News, Hillary Burns from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Eric Frazier from the Charlotte Observer.
A couple. Glad you took your ginkgo for that reintroduction.
Thank you very much. A few weeks ago, who are you?
Brutal.
Who are
Brutal.
You? Why are you here?
Brutal.
I think you'll be disinvited. a few weeks ago, outgoing city manager Ron Carley recommended a 1% property tax increase to fund the city's needs, but city council members have been working on ways to avoid what would be a third property tax increase in 3 years. They've talked about eliminating garbage pickup at apartments and things like that, but they also want to fund the hiring of 50 new police officers. So where does that stand this week?
Amazing what you suggest when you're on your way out, huh?
Yeah. Well, now they're talking about increasing the trash pickup for apartment complexes from what? $26 to $50?
$25 to $56.
Yeah.
And this would be the third, to be clear, it would be the third tax increase in 4 years.
4 years, I'm sorry.
So it's funny because I remember covering this last year when we had the huge budget shortfall and everybody starts, you know, saying, hey, look, let's take a look at the way that we deal with this trash issue. So Charlotte as a city does pick up from apartment buildings, townhomes, and complexes. And there are many cities who don't. So the question keeps coming up, should we just make those apartments, condos, and townhomes pay for trash pickup themselves, take it off the city's toll, or dole rather, and make somebody else pick up the tab for it? And what, you know, this is seeming to me like kind of the new budgetary low-hanging fruit, because we just see this popping up again.
But isn't it the government's job to supply services through tax dollars? Isn't that their job?
I think by definition, yes.
So when you start eliminating services, what does that mean?
Well, you know, I would say that the city would argue that they're not eliminating services. They're taking some services away from people who in other cities don't necessarily get this service, that being trash.
You should get a job in PR.
And using it to supply other services, more needed services, I'm sure they would argue, being fire and police. But it's a great question that you raise. And either way, this is going to come down to the pocketbooks of apartment dwellers and condo owners in Uptown and other areas in Charlotte, because it seems like one way or another, they really, really, really want to make this happen.
Well, and I think it's the people not in Uptown that the folks who are against taking away this trash collection service are really citing that this is going to have the cost. If a apartment or multifamily complex has to go pay a private trash collector to come pick up their trash, the apartment association has said that cost is going to be passed along to
sure.
their residents. And they've made the point that many of the city's low-income families live in multifamily complexes and can't afford to pay additional rent. And so they've essentially told the city council, if you do this, you'll be very negatively impacting low-income residents across the city of Charlotte.
And that's true. But there's also, you know, a lot of all these apartments that are going up now are all high end. So you're also, I think I've heard it argued from the city staff's point of view that it's an inefficient way. If the city wants to help low income renters, this is an inefficient way to do it, because so much of that subsidy, because I guess that's what it is, the trash pickup, is going to apartment complexes that do not house low-income people. I think what I'm kind of sympathetic to that point of view, but I think if the city does this, they need to do something to offset the impact for low-income renters, because that is, you know, that they most low-income people in Charlotte, they live in apartments. So they need to do something. They can't do one, I don't think, without doing the other.
And let's be clear. I mean, either way, if they do not do that 1% property tax increase, they'll say, hey, we didn't raise fee. We didn't do a property tax increase. You know, that's the message will be sent out. But just as fees are a form of tax with another name, this too would be a form of a tax for those people who live in these buildings, because one way or another, they're what they have to pay for what has been to this point a basic service. It's going to go up.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Councilmember Julie Iselt has proposed adding 13 officers to the 50 already proposed for next year at a cost of $1.1 million. Where would that money come from?
It's a great question, and I don't think anyone knows exactly, and I think that's why we're you know, this trash debate is really connected to finding the money to pay for the 50 more officers that we want to hire, and additional dispatchers and support staff. What, 80 support staff and 50 officers?
And isn't that down from 200 and some officers that the police chief wanted to hire?
125.
And I think it's interesting. The underlying issue underlying all of this is the fact that Charlotte doesn't have the money to pay for all the things it needs. And even if you raise the tax this year, there's no guarantee that they can pay for these new positions next year.
And why not? Why can't we? Where is that? Why don't we have
that? Well, the argument that I think Ron Carley would make if he were here is that, you know, they lost that $18 million in the business privilege,
business license privilege.
The General Assembly took away.
Yeah, and that this is a way to recoup some of that money by basically hitting, I guess, quote-unquote, rich apartment developers,
all right,
rich multifamily developers.
The school board voted 8-1 this week to ask the county for $425 million for funding. It's been described by some as a bare bones request, but it is 5.6% or $23 million more than last year. There are board members who say it's just not enough. What are the chances of county commission agreeing to this additional funding? Anybody know?
I think this is – I thought it was interesting to see such vehement dislike for this request from the school board. However, I think it's every year in every county I've ever lived in North Carolina, the school board wants more money and the county commissioners don't want to give them that money. And then they go and fight and duke it out. I mean, look at Union County, where the school board was in a lawsuit with their county commissioners. I think this request is far more realistic. It may not meet all of the needs, but we can't always get all of what we want. Just ask Ron Carley, what we were just talking about. And so for better or for worse, I think Ann Clark is doing the school board a service by saying, look, let's do a realistic request. It's still an increase, and it's probably still going to get pushed back from the county commissioners.
And, you know, the reason I think they're doing a realistic instead of, you know, throw everything at the wall and see how much of it we can get back kind of budget, which is what normally happens, is that they have their eye on that bond issue.
Yes.
And so they want the county to approve that, so they don't want to tick the county off by, you know, sort of padding their request in their operating budget. So we'll see what happens.
It was an 8-1 vote on the school board. The no vote came from Erica Ellis Stewart, who said that she couldn't vote for a budget request that lacks money to fix failing schools, expand pre-kindergarten, and increase the number of school social workers, psychologists, and counselors, saying that the needs of our students continue not to be met.
I think that would normally be the budget that would have come forward. It would have done those things.
And so how much more money would that require to do that?
Millions upon millions.
Well, that's the problem, right, is you could always use more money to make your schools better. But at some point you have to draw the line between what you're actually going to get and what is reasonable. And I think Eric makes a great point on, you know, we have a bigger apple we're trying to get at, so let's cool it a little bit.
Gaston County residents got a postcard this week, an interesting postcard from the State Department of Transportation telling them that all activities for the Gaston East-West Connector or the Garden Parkway have been stopped. That means the project is now dead in the water, done, not going to come back.
Yes, unless they decide to bring it back.
They who?
That would be state officials.
That seems to be one hard road to kill, boy. Yeah. Who knows?
Why this announcement
now? We'll
start
calling it the Lazarus Parkway. It does seem to come back time and again.
Why this announcement now, and why by postcard? Is that how they normally do things?
That's weird. I went there. Someone said I've never seen anything like that. Well, hundreds, right? 500 postcards? That is strange.
No, it's efficient.
Yeah, well, I guess it is. And everybody knows it because it's not in a sealed envelope. The General Assembly has been doing things other than HB2.
No.
Yes, they've been working on toughening penalties for drunken boating, on reviving coal ash oversight, and cutting off money to sanctuary cities. Let's start with coal ash. They're trying to reconstitute the Coal Ash Management Commission, which the governor disbanded this year. Remind us why, and what are they trying to do by reconstituting this?
Well, to be fair, the governor challenged this in state court, and it was a court who decided that the commission was, in fact, it was breaking the Constitution of North Carolina because the General Assembly was picking the commissioners.
Not the governor.
And not the governor. I mean, there's percentages, but that's what it basically comes down to. And this all boils just back to a simple idea that's going to be a whole lot more complicated than I'm going to make it sound, which is what to do with coal ash, what to do with the coal ash ponds that are around, and which dams need to be, emptied first, and what is an appropriate way to deal with that coal ash. Mm-hmm. So by reconstituting it, it's basically this has been a fascinating little power struggle between the governor and the Republican-dominated legislature over who gets to make those decisions.
Well, I think it's an interesting message from the General Assembly that essentially they say that there needs to be additional oversight more than what there already is. And I think that message is only backed up and supported when you see things like the story that came out last night about, you know, how they're the McCrory administration's relationship with Duke Energy. And I think this is Republican lawmakers saying we probably need some additional oversight here still.
Mm. What about the drunken boating thing they're working on? Are there not laws in place about operating a boat?
Well, I know every year we see these cases, it seems like every year, on Lake Norman in the summer where somebody gets drunk, goes on a boat, and, you know, hurts somebody else really badly. So I guess there's a feeling that the laws that are in place, because I know that there are police patrols on Lake Norman, there must be a feeling that they're not sufficient.
Are the laws in place not equal to the drunk driving laws?
No. They're not. And I think that's really what they're trying to get to. I mean, I don't know the specifics just off the top of my head, but in essence, a fatality caused in a drunk boating accident is treated more like just an accident.
Ah.
The fines are significantly lower than what you would see if the exact same incident happened on dry land with a car.
Last year, the legislature voted to ban local governments from having sanctuary city policies that limit the enforcement of immigration laws, and now they want to cut off state funding to cities, towns, and counties that don't comply. How similar is this to the Obama administration cutting off Title IX funding over HB2, something the legislature said isn't fair?
It's 100% similar. That's how similar.
There is an irony there. In fact, going back to that the Twitter comment you read earlier, yeah, there is a sense of irony there. I mean, it's really interesting because I was reading, in fact, I have it in front of me now, again, Senate Pro Tem Phil Berger basically saying it's important to withhold the funds if cities aren't following the law.
Mm.
And it's, you know, it is, in fact, as we've seen time and again when it comes to everything from House Bill 2 on down, this is just the same thing that they complain about, but when they're doing it, it's okay.
Although it's interesting, legislative Republicans have come out with an argument which is at least interesting and worthy of some discussion and consideration. They say that under the North Carolina Constitution, the state legislature has more oversight over cities and counties than, say, the federal government has over states, just because of how our U.S. Constitution and our state constitutions are set up. And so they point to that and say, well, the Constitution gives us this additional oversight ability, and clearly they are taking it now. But I think all of these three topics that you just brought up is important to note too, Mike, on a question that you didn't ask, that there are other things going on in the legislature, and legislative Republicans that I've spoke with said they didn't come to Raleigh this session even planning to talk about HB2, that they have a lot of other things going on. And so I think it's fascinating to see how much this has grown.
Well, one of the other things they're talking about is a bill that would drastically lower tuition at the state's historically black universities, and believe it or not, there's controversy over that. With the ever-rising cost of college education, why would there be people against that?
Well, it goes even further than that. They're talking about freezing, I think, tuition for 4 years. If you graduate in 4 years, your tuition would not increase over those 4 years.
For all universities.
Yeah. And they're also...
Why is that controversial?
And they're also restraining fees, which colleges use. The controversy is that there's a feeling that if you lower rates as low as they're talking about lowering them, $500 a semester at these five schools, that will destabilize the system because you'll have more people wanting to maybe go to those schools. Maybe the other schools will have trouble keeping as many students as they have, which would impact their budgets. And also, this bill does not specify how they're going to make up the shortfall. Because if you cut tuition by that much, that low, that's going to be a drastic reduction in the revenue budgets of those schools. They haven't said what would happen then. Would they reduce costs? Or would they pump in more money from somewhere else, maybe by increasing out-of-state fees at the other schools? So the other schools are kind of worried about what exactly does all this mean, ultimately.
And they are talking about raising the cap on out-of-state students who would pay a higher rate. Mm. But the trick with this is there's a clear argument here that's an economy of scale, that you can, in fact, make up the budget shortfall by making sure that you get these more students. But you need the facilities to handle them.
Yeah.
And we're not sure what that is.
Despite the Hornets being wiped off the map by Miami, we have some basketball news to celebrate this week. The Golden State Warriors, Stephen Curry, a Charlottean, has made basketball history. Talk about that.
Davidson grad. That's pretty awesome. Right down the road.
He was the third point guard in history to win the NBA's MVP award twice. But unlike the other two players who had this achievement, Magic Johnson and Steve Nash, he won by unanimous vote, 131 votes. Yeah, now, these votes are cast by members of the media. So does that make this honor any more or less valid? Is this like the Golden Globes of the foreign press voting?
No. Here's the thing. He is the only player in the NBA in history to be unanimously elected as the most valuable player. That includes Jordan, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, you name it.
Then why does he play for the wrong team? That's what I want to know.
Oh, I think Oakland would say he plays for the right one.
Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Nick Oxner from WBTV News, Hillary Burns from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Eric Frazier from the Charlotte Observer. Thank you all for the hour.